Okay, this evening's talk, in a few moments when everyone's come in, who's coming in, those people are going out, is going out. Another request which somebody gave me last week, it was free will. We're going to talk about free will tonight. So, see what can happen when everybody is free to go out, the will's to come in. Coming up next time, actually, somebody just asked me that. That's probably a couple of weeks, another week. Yeah, next week is Sister Wyoming's talk. The week afterwards I'll be giving another talk, and that's supposed to be on reincarnation. So I'm going off to Singapore tonight, but I promised I will be reincarnated here in 2 weeks' time, in time to give the talk on reincarnation. But this evening's on free will. And what does that really mean, free will? Sometimes it's interesting, the idea of freedom is something which people just do not understand. And the word free, it's like the word for free speech. I wrote a little story some time ago, that even like free speech, I don't believe in free speech. Do you believe in free speech? I don't. I think that they should charge for it. Because if they charged and put a tax on free speech, it would be great, then people wouldn't be able to talk so much. Imagine what it would be like in the supermarkets. People would not spend so much time on the checking counter, because every time they spoke, you'd be charged. And all of your teenage children, they wouldn't be able to spend so much time on the phone, because they'd be charged for it. Imagine if that was taxed, and all the people who talk so much, they'd be the ones who actually pay for the roads. And the people who talk the most, the politicians, ha ha ha, they'd be the ones who actually pay for the things that, which they spend the money on. So I think it would be a very good idea not to have free speech, because then silence really would be golden again. We could have silence in the world. So I really don't like the idea of free speech, because people talk too much. And we think too much as well. So should we have free thought? Should you really be a free thinker? Or should we charge for it? It would be a wonderful way of actually raising funds for our Buddhist society. Every time you thought something, we could charge you for it. A little meter would go off in your brain. Tick, 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 tick. That's $10 for the Buddhist Society of West Australia. But what about free will? Why should will be free either? Because it's will which starts the thoughts. What do you actually mean by free? In this evening's talk, what I'm going to say, I think, if it happens, is that freedom and will are two opposite things. That when you will, you have no freedom. And when will stops, there you have freedom. So in the words of English language, free will is an oxymoron. What the two words are contradictory to each other. I'm going to explain what that means in a few moments. I always like to sort of stir people up when I give talks, to give actually some ideas which you haven't heard before. Because we say free will, and straight away we think what that really means is that every human being is allowed to actually to think, to will, whatever they want. And it's one of those ideals which we take for granted in this Western world of being good. But is it good? And is it real anyway? I've given stories before, talks before, about the nature of will and just how it isn't free at all. But to be able to understand what the will is, what is this choosing, doing, thinking, willing person, or being, or thing itself? Let's even take it away from a person. Will in itself, what is it? And there's the general principle which I learnt in science as a scientist at Cambridge. You can't really get to know something when you're right in the middle of it. The old simile of a tadpole born in the water, raised in the water, spent all its life in the water. How can it know what water is? There's no way in the world can you know what water is when water is all around you. But one day that tadpole grows into a frog and leaves that lake or that pond, that body of water. And once it gets outside, when water's not there anymore, only then can it truly understand what water is. How can we understand what will is? When will is all around us. When we've been willing since the time we were born. Some people are willing, some people aren't willing. But that's not what I really meant. What I'm talking about is, you've been having will all the time. Have you ever known a time of conscious experience when that hasn't been there? To be able to understand what will is, you have to get to those stages where will stops. And I was mentioning that path to you during the meditation. You're letting go of the control freak, I was calling it. That's the will. Letting go of the doer. Allowing things to be. Not managing things. Not making things happen. Leaving them alone. Stopping. Willing. Not doing anything. Can you manage that? Can you manage just to let things go, allow things to stop? Sometimes people ask me, what's the quickest way to meditation? Just don't do anything. How many people can do that? They find it so difficult to do. Just sit there, don't do anything. No one is going to judge you. You don't have to sort of win brownie points by meditating. You're not going to be sort of given a prize for the best meditator. Just sit down and do nothing. That's so hard for a person to do. Why? It's because they're under the tyranny of their will. The will not allow you to rest. The will is always pushing and pulling you, making you think, making you change, never allowing you a moment's rest. But through this type of meditation, sometimes you can press the right buttons. You can let go until the will completely disappears. And those are the occasions in the very deep meditations when there is no will at all. There is no choosing. There is no doing. Only from that point, when you're a little tadpole, you've grown into a frog, you've got outside of the lake, then you can really understand what will is. For those of you who know this path of meditation, the will stops in what we call the second jhana. That's when you're so still, you can't move. That's where when people tap you on the shoulder, you can't feel them. That's why you sit meditation sometimes for hours. You can't come out. Because there's no will left to take you out of that meditation experience. Now that might sound weird to many of you, but that's actually true. That's one of the characteristics of that deep stage of meditation. Where you're almost like a stone. Perfectly alert. Blissed out of your little skull. But unable to move because will has stopped. When you come out from that stage, then of course you are like the tadpole who's been out of the lake, gone back into the lake. He has a good idea of what will truly is. So that's the first point. The only way you can know what will, choosing, doing, controlling really is when you let go of control, doing, will so much that you can't move. You're absolutely still. Because isn't it what will which makes us tremble? Isn't it will which makes us stop being at peace? Isn't will which makes us run backwards and forwards, trying to gather this, do that, get rid of something else, change that, sort this out, fix that? Isn't that what will does? Isn't will the great tyrant, like this torture guard who always makes you do this and do that? Now you're starting to see that will is quite opposite from freedom. Free will is an oxymoron. Two words coming together, which mean the opposite. Strange, because we just assume it's our nature to will. And by willing, we can get our happiness in the world, we can control our world. How many of you have been trying to control your world since you were born? You can't even control your husband. How do you reckon you can control the world? You can't even control your kids. And how many headaches does that give you? You can't even control yourself. Can you? And sometimes we have all this will. And will promises us that if only we only will wisely enough, skillfully enough, strongly enough, then you can get whatever you want in the world. Some people pay thousands of dollars going to these seminars by important people who have good hairdos and fine suits. That's why I will never go to such places. Because I've got just a horrible hairdo and I don't wear suits. But if you have a sharp suit and a good hairdo, you can go to these places and charge thousands and thousands of dollars. And all they do is say, if you really want it, you can get it. You've got a will, you've got to imagine your goals. You've got to visualize your dreams. You can do it. You can make it. You can make it happen. Go for it. And the only people who get anything out of that are the organizers. I went to somebody, I was in Sydney, they'd just been to one of these big seminars. And I said, how was it? And they said, oh, it's fabulous. I said, really? And they had to say it's fabulous when I heard out they paid $7,000 for it. For a weekend. $7,000, my goodness. So I'm in the wrong business. I should really... I could make a fortune. But anyway, no, you wouldn't do that because that's really sort of unsavory. And it's also, it is unsavory making lots of money. What do you want lots of money for? What would you do with all that money anyway? What do you want money for? People want money because they think once you've got money, then you are free for your will to actually to achieve whatever you want. The only reason your will hasn't managed to get you happiness yet because you haven't had the means yet. It all just complicates up this will business. If I will long enough, hard enough, get the means, then I can get whatever I want. Will is what promises you happiness, control, safety, security. But does it ever give you those things? If you're very wealthy, are you really happy? And if you have a big house, is it big enough? I know lots of people who have big houses who even at this moment have got their extensions in the council waiting for approval. How many people, how big a house do you want? You can only be in one room at a time. So why not have those houses where you have your sort of dining room, living room, sort of family room, all in one room. It would be much better. Isn't it the case that, you know, in years gone by, we all lived in a very small houses, and families were so big that we learned how to get on together, that we had our friendship of families all together. Now we have these big houses. We have these big houses, everyone's got their own room and TV. Everyone's got their own ensuite. And your family, they're just like lodgers in a hotel, you never see them. Have we lost something there by going too far? What do you want wealth for? You know, poverty can sometimes be a great blessing. You have to live together, you have to work together. You have to get on. I think it'd be wonderful if we have sort of people living together more in small houses. Make it small houses. So that way that people have to learn how to communicate with each other, how to work together, how to have harmony, how to forgive. And maybe that's one of the reasons why there's so many divorces going on, because as kids these days they don't learn how to get on with their sisters and brothers. We've all got our own room, we can just do whatever we want. We never learn how to cooperate. Anyway, that's aside, and that's nothing to do with free will, but nevertheless, I just added that in. But when we have this will, you know, we think that we're going to get somewhere by willing hard enough. How many of you, you know, when something goes wrong, you think, I didn't will hard enough, I didn't will properly enough. And you so try again, next time trying harder, which means willing harder. It never gets you anywhere, it just gets you headaches all the time. Can you control the world? And obviously, you know, you may try to control the world, but you just say how little you can control. And it's all because we will these things to be somehow different. There comes a time when we actually go in an opposite direction. Instead of willing, we have no willing. We just stop this whole process of controlling and trying to change things. It's amazing what happens when you start trying to control people. You know, look at my monastery down at Serpentine. I think the monks will tell you, I'm not a control freak. I don't keep telling them what to do. I just encourage them. And it's amazing just how much more you can get harmony, get progress, get success when you don't try and control people so much. You know what it's like at work, some of you? You get this boss who always just makes you work hard, is always shouting at you, never praising, never encouraging you. This willing person who's got this great goal, he has to reach this because they've gone to these $7,000 weekend seminars. They should come here instead. They save money and get much better advice. But when they hear these things, what's it like living with a person like that? Can you actually work with them? What's it like under a person who's like a tyrant? After a while, you just can't stand that job. You want to go somewhere else. And you realize that when your boss, instead of is like a tyrant, always telling you what to do, ordering you, being forceful, if you're with a boss who's encouraging, who's kind, who's understanding, then you find actually that you're not forced to work hard for such a person. You find you want to work hard for such a person. The person encourages you, inspires you, they're a good person, they're trying hard, they're kind to me, I want to be kind to them. That's certainly the way that I've run the monastery down at Serpentine, by being kind to my monks. They are kind back to me. It's called the law of karma. Now this is an example. If you're a tyrant, if you're mean to others, others will be mean to you. And isn't a lot of will being mean to yourself? Willing yourself so hard, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, come on, get your act together, me. Instead, can't we be kind to ourselves? This is what I call that tyrant inside each one of us, that very, very hard will, which pushes us. And unfortunately, our cultures say, yeah, we've got to sort of create that will, that strength of will. Be a strong-willed person, then you'll succeed in life. What do you really succeed in? Are you really happy when you have a strong will? Or is it you're just carrying a tyrant around in your brain all the time? Always never giving you a moment's peace. So you've got to work harder, you've got to make more money, you've got to get on in your company, you've got to get on in your monastery. My goodness, you've been 8 years as a monk, you're not the abbot yet. Or whatever it is, surely can't we sort of stop that business and just be kind instead? Because when we stop the will, instead we can have like the kindness as well. The kindness instead. What is kindness? What is loving kindness? You've heard me say this before. It's a beautiful description of what love truly is. The door of my heart is open to you no matter who you ever are, no matter what you do. My own father's description of loving kindness, the door of my heart is open to you no matter who you are, no matter what you've ever done. Come in. Now, is there any will involved in that? Or is it an ending of will? A freedom of will? Freedom rather from will? I know certainly my father was not a willful person. He was the one who taught me that. And he was quite happy no matter what I did in life. In fact, you know, when, I remember when I started to do well at school. And he went to one of these parent-teacher's nights. And I think that was the first time that the teacher said to him how what I was doing and said, oh, he'd probably go to university. And my father got very upset. And apparently I heard the next day from my fellow classmates that he almost had a fight with my teacher. My father didn't want me to go to university. Simply because that he thought that would take me away from him. He was a simple working class man. And he thought, oh, if his son goes to university, he will lose me as a friend. Of course, it was just a misunderstanding of what happens when you go to university. But for him, for a working class person, it was as if I was going to another echelon which he could never reach. He soon changed his mind and was very happy. But it was interesting, just sort of the way these things actually work. He wasn't a willful person. He would allow me to do things. He would give me that freedom. He was not a tyrant. Because he wasn't a tyrant, because he sort of cared for me so much, my response was I really wanted to do the very best for such a man. You always reach up to live up to such acceptance, such trust, such love. And it's the same in a business. If as a boss, the boss is caring and kind for the people underneath them, for the workers, if they're understanding, caring, yeah, we've got a job to do, but now, if you're too ill, then don't do it today. Then people would work harder. You get much more out of the job. Actually, I should have brought this along today if I knew what I was going to say, but I never really understand what I'm going to say before I say it. But on my wall by my desk, there was a little article which came from a business journal of United Kingdom, where a particular business had won a prize for productivity because it had banned overtime. He said, do workers, you have to go home to your families at a certain time. Now you can't sort of keep on doing this overtime, so you neglect your private life, you neglect your health, you neglect your recreation. And so this company, they insisted everybody go home on time, no overtime. And they did so many other little things actually to care for the company that the staff turnover went so far down that people stayed in their jobs for year after year after year. So all this retraining of staff, you know, they didn't have to spend any money on that. The staff really cared for a company which cared for them. Their profits, their productivity went up so much, it won a business award in the UK as an example of how kindness and caring actually work for an economic concern, a company, a business. And that sort of impressed me, because that's actually what happens not just with a company, not just with a monastery, but with ourselves. We should care for ourselves more instead of being so willful. By willful we say, look, I shouldn't have done this. That's being willing. You know, willing to be better, willing to do this. Sort of the tyrant inside of you, which is always telling you what to do. Can't we have just even a moment's peace from that tyrant? Otherwise it will be moving you, willing you to do this and that from the time you were born to the time you would die. Come on me, do well, you've got to pass your exams when you're young. Come on, do well, get a nice partner, get a pretty one, get a nice sort of rich husband. Come on, do well at school, your job. Come on, sort of do well in your career. Come on, try harder to get a good house. Come on, try harder to be successful. Come on, try harder to meditate when you come to a temple. Come on, try harder to go to heaven after you die. Always willing ourselves to try and sort of live up to something. We're always moving, being pushed. Do you ever find or feel inside you're always being pushed around? You're never being accepted. You're never being have this feeling of freedom just to be who you are. Do you understand how will and freedom are two opposites? Every now and again, we have to stop the journey. We have to just stop and rest. Every now and again, we have to turn off the engine of our car. The engine of our car is will, what drives us through life. If we're always being driven through life by our will, whenever can we have any rest, any peace? It's wonderful if we can just stop willing for a while and just stop. Trouble is, a lot of time, we sort of, the only time, or when we say stop willing, we try and will ourselves to stop willing. And of course, that's not stopping at all, that's more willing. And it's the same with this opposite of willing. You probably have all figured it out by now. The opposite of will is letting go. And this is one of the hardest things to do nothing. You say, come on, do nothing. That's more doing. Let go. Come on, let go. That's not letting go. That's making yourself let go. That's willing yourself to let go. For those of you who have been meditating a while, can you understand what your mistake is? You're letting go of the wrong thing. You should be letting go of the will. Allowing will to stop. So you allow the world just to be. You're not willing it to be any different. Through wisdom, you're understanding just how everything in this world has its place. I said this last week, but I've been saying this for many times in my monastery. I told it to just one of the Anagarikas this morning. You look at our monastery. And I pointed out a dead tree. I said, don't cut that down, because that's the place where the birds nest. The dead trees in a monastery are just so important. So are the sick trees. So are the old trees. So are the young trees. Every tree in the forest has its place. So why do we want to change it? Every person in the world has their place. So why do we want to change things? You are perfect as you are. Why do you want to change things through will? We always want to be different. We always want to be better. We always think we can somehow achieve something more. But when we actually stop, especially in our spiritual life, and we stop all those willing business, Only then can we accept ourselves as we are. Only then can we have some rest. Only then can we ever find any peace. Otherwise, if you cultivate will again and again and again and again and again, you find you will never have any peace in your life. Never have any satisfaction. Never have a place where you can truly rest. Unfortunately, this thing called will is so conditioned into us, it's very hard to stop. It's as if this thing just has a mind of its own. And this is actually, it does have a mind of its own. This is what we call ourself, our being, me. So often we think it's me who does this willing. That's why I like to tell a couple of stories, just to prove that it's not you at all. You can let go of willing when you realize it's nothing to do with you. It's been put in there by somebody else. Those stories I have about, because I always thought that I was the one who was doing the willing. And I always thought, in the way that most people understand free will, that you can choose to do whatever you want. I thought this was a free society until I started learning some basic psychology. And you understand that this thing which you call choice and will, it doesn't come from you at all. It's conditioned. You've all been brainwashed. One of the first times I realized this, when I was a young man, how many young people want to be rebels? I decided to be a rebel. And I got my green velvet trousers, even though my mother didn't like that at all. This was in the late 60s. And I was so proud of my green velvet trousers. I was the only one who had green velvet trousers, I thought, until I went to one of these rock concerts, these rock festivals, where thousands of people came to listen to these rock bands. And that was the time I found 10,000 other people with green velvet trousers. I wasn't being an individual at all, I was just wearing another uniform. It's called fashion. Why do you wear the clothes you wear? Fashion, why do you choose those things? Why is your hairstyle like it is? Did you freely choose to have your hair that particular way? Did you freely choose to wear those particular clothes? Or were you just brainwashed by the fashion industry to wear those things? Look at what people have, these designer clothes, you know, it's Gucci sort of robes or Versace gowns. I've sometimes seen them in the newspapers. I mean, some of those fashion shows, they look really weird, as if like crazy people's clothes. But people actually buy thousands, they pay immense amount of money for those things. What do you do that for? It's only because you're brainwashed. No one in their sane mind would actually buy those sorts of things. Because they're not in their sane mind. They've been completely controlled by the fashion industry, just as you have. Why is it when you go to a supermarket, you buy that particular brand of muesli? Because you've seen it being advertised. The second thing which I remember, just the way I'd been brainwashed, you've heard this story before, but it's actually it's a very funny story. I saw this advertisement, I remember this very clearly, when I was a young man, of St. Bruno Tobacco. And in this particular advertisement on the TV, this ordinary looking man, wasn't particularly beautiful, not particularly strong or big or handsome, this ordinary man, started smoking some St. Bruno tobacco in his pipe. And as he lit the pipe, as the aroma sort of started spreading, this amazingly beautiful girl working in a bank just smelled it, was completely obsessed, jumped over the counter and started following him. And then another person from the newsagent, this beautiful young girl, also completely obsessed, jumped over her counter and followed him in about a few seconds, only a few seconds in advertisement. This ordinary man was being followed by these amazingly beautiful girls, because St. Bruno tobacco was like that. So once you smoke it, you become incredibly attractive. That was what the advert said. It's actually stupid, isn't it? I mean, who could believe that? I did. I got some St. Bruno tobacco. Unfortunately, it didn't work for me. I wasn't followed by beautiful women who jumped over counters, stopped whatever they were doing because I was... But you just, you do that, don't you? We actually buy these products simply because of what's been shown on the TV, and we really think we're in control. We really think that our will, the reason why we chose that, was out of our own free choice. And that starts to make us very, makes it very spooky. What you choose to do, how much actually comes from you, and how much has been brainwashed into you. I've been told that many of the monks at my monastery start talking like me. That's what happens, because you brainwash all the monks. I don't know if I do. When I was last in Singapore, I'm just going back there again, we're having a conference over there in a week or two. And just to liven things up there, there's this fellow in Singapore who's he's a stand-up comedian, and he's also a ventriloquist, he's a juggler. And he was going to do like a bit of entertainment at this Buddhist conference. I said, oh, ventriloquist. Why didn't he get like a little dummy just like me and call it sort of, you know, Little Brahm or something? And he said, yeah, that's a good idea, you might do it. It'd be very interesting to get a ventriloquist dummy just like me. But really, we've got about, how many monks we've got in our monastery? 20 monks? Just like the same. Because a lot of times, isn't it the case we sort of imitate each other? Why do we imitate each other? It's because of actually our will. Where does it actually come from? We think we're in control. A lot of times, we are not. Our will is conditioned into us by our society, by our parents, by our religion. That's why you can't really blame anybody. They choose to do that because that's all they've heard. A lot of our will is completely conditioned. Another story about will, which again really shook me, was when as a college student, I went to this demonstration by a hypnotist who would get this whole whole group of students. I was one of them. I tried to see if I was a hypnotic subject. He said no, I wasn't. I was very happy afterwards when I found out what happened to somebody who was a hypnotic subject. Because they hypnotized this student completely. And in front of all the people watching, this hypnotist said, later on, I'm going to give you a suggestion. When I touch my right ear, you are going to stand up and sing the national anthem. It's the British national anthem, God Save the Queen. And then he gave him a post-hypnotic suggestion. Well, he took him out of hypnosis, but before he did, he said, you won't remember anything which I've just told you, but you will remember when I touched my ear to stand up and sing the British national anthem. And when he took this young student out of hypnosis, he sent him back to his chair. And of course, we'd all seen what was happening. And just like every other student in that lecture, I couldn't wait until that sort of hypnotist actually touched his ear. He was waiting for it. He came close a few times. I'm sure he was sort of just winding us up. But then he actually touched his ear. And as soon as he touched his right ear, this student, in the middle of the lecture, in the lecture hall of maybe 100 students, he stood up and in a loud voice sang, God Save the Queen. And everyone else burst out laughing, but he wouldn't stop, he just carried on till the end. And it's so embarrassing. And we asked him afterwards, so he's asked, why did you do that? And he gave a cogent reason. To him, he thought he'd freely chose to sing the British National Anthem in the middle of a lecture. To us, it was quite clear he'd been completely conditioned. When we saw that, we realized the things which I do. Are they really coming from me? Or are they just conditioned by my parents, by my friends, by my society? When you actually look deeply into it, it is all completely conditioned. You have been controlled by your society, by your upbringing, by your conditioning. That's a weird thing to actually to understand. But once you understand it, once you know what's going on, you know just how this mind is completely subject to conditioning. At least you can condition it in a good way. You can condition it in a good way by coming to the Buddhist Society of West Australia on a Friday afternoon or Friday evening instead of watching the TV. It's much cheaper. You don't have to buy so much. But more than that, once you understand just how the mind is conditioned, you can work with those conditionings. What we call it in my monastery is learning how to program yourself, program mindfulness. Because sometimes people actually come along and they say they've got these problems in their life. Sometimes, for example, they're angry people. They say, I can't stop getting angry. What should I do? They say, well, look, that anger is conditioned. You can recondition yourself. And how you program mindfulness is that when you're not feeling angry, when you're feeling relaxed, you sit down and you make resolutions to yourself. You say, when this trigger happens, you find out this person or this event, and maybe just because you get tired, or maybe when you come home after a busy day at work, and you get angry at your wife or your husband or your kids or whatever, find out the trigger, find out your situation, and when you're far away from that situation, when you relax, tell yourself, look, when I come home, I will not get angry at my wife. When I come home, I will not get angry at my wife. When I come home, I will not get angry at my wife. You repeat it to yourself 2 or 3 times. That's what I do. Not that I've got a wife, but it's other situations. I'm a very good monk. But another, this is just an example. You make that resolution to yourself, and it's amazing just how it works. Now you find that you've made that resolution to yourself, you've actually programmed your mind, you've brainwashed yourself, you've conditioned yourself, like self-hypnosis. And then you come home from work, the same old situation, you're about to follow the same obsessive habits, and you're about to get angry, and something comes up into your mind and says, no, I won't. And after a while you realize that that's come up because you put that conditioning in there. You've deliberately reconditioned your mind. It's amazing how powerful that is. If you don't believe me, try this experiment tonight. It's a very common meditation experiment. When you go to sleep tonight, whatever time you want to get up in the morning, say it's at 8 o'clock, put your alarm clock to 8:05, just in case, so you don't have to worry about anything. 8:05. If this doesn't work, great, you get an extra 5 minutes sleep. Put your alarm clock at 8:05, and then before you go to sleep, when you're laying down in your bed, before you close your eyes, say, I will wake up at 8 o'clock sharp. I will wake up at 8 o'clock sharp. I'll wake up at 8 o'clock sharp. Say that to yourself 3 times as carefully as you can. So you're really listening to yourself. It's amazing, just you will wake up at 8 o'clock within 1 or 2 minutes either side, without any alarm. You've conditioned your mind to wake up at a certain time. The first time I did that was my first meditation retreat when I was an 18, 19 year old student. I couldn't believe just how well it worked. Now I understand why it works. You're actually programming your mind. At that particular time, this is what you're going to do. And that's a great way for overcoming obsessions. If anyone has like an obsession with alcohol, they're an alcoholic. They can actually do that. When they're away from the beer, you tell yourself, I will not, now when I see that bottle of alcohol, in those dangerous situations, you program yourself, when I see that bottle of alcohol, I will not take it up. I will not pick it up. I will not pick it up. You program that into your mind. You can recondition yourself to change. Maybe it takes a bit of a while before you can recondition yourself. It's like a person training in sport. You know, the people who are training in sport, you watch them in their training, like on tennis. They keep on just doing the same action over and over and over and over again until they condition themselves. That's how they react when a ball is like that, because in the actual game things go so fast, you haven't got time to think in real life because it flows so fast. We just act out of our conditioning, how we've been trained. how we've been brainwashed. And this is the way we recondition ourselves. When we understand where all this comes from, it's amazing what we can do. Even in our meditation. Sometimes, at the goal of a teacher, I teach these things again and again and again and again. And I'm brainwashing you. I admit that. You get brainwashed every Friday you come here. And what happens is, you go home, you're about to get angry, something comes up, what Ajahn Brahm said, what Sitar Ajahn Wayama said, and it stops you. It changes you for the better. So this is actually how this all works. This is actually how you can actually, because you know what will is, you know where it comes from, you can actually work with your will. You can actually change it. So obsessive or negative choices, sort of destructive will, can be altered. You just tell yourself what to do. And you know why you tell yourself what to do? Because I told you what to do. I brainwashed you to change from taking alcohol. Brainwashed you to change to getting angry. Brainwashed to tell you to being more kind. Even brainwashed you to be more generous. There's an old story. I can't resist telling. This is a brainwashing story. Hypnosis story. I tried to tell this at our last Katina ceremony, but Ajahn Yana was there and he stopped me. But I'm going to go for it this time. That's right. For those of you who remember that, who didn't know the punchline, there was this poor priest. And this poor priest is only a young fellow, and he didn't give very good sermons, so he didn't get much on his collection plate. And so because of that, he sort of was finding it very, very hard to make ends meet. So he went to see his superior, his bishop, and the bishop said, look, the same thing happened to me when I started out, you know, being a priest. Very hard to actually get people inspired, hardly got anything. So what I did, I tried hypnosis. He said, on one Sunday afternoon, he said, I turned up the temperature in the room. I gave a very boring sermon in a monotone. When people were about to fall asleep, I got out my watch. I did it backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And when everyone was hypnotized, I gave them the suggestion, only $10 notes, no fives, no coins. 20s will do, 50s all right as well. But no coins, no $5 notes. He said, it worked a treat. And so the priest said, I can't do that. He said, of course you can, it's for God. It's like here, it's for the Buddha, it's for good karma. So you want you to make good karma, so it's okay to brainwash you. So he tried it out. The next Sunday, he turned. You notice how the temperature's up in this room this evening? he turned the temperature up. He gave a very boring sermon. No jokes like I give. See, I'm a good mark. I don't brainwash you. He gave a very boring sermon. And it was in a monotone. When everyone was about to fall asleep, he got his watch out. Backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. Until they were all hypnotized. Then he said, $10, $20, $50, $100, no fives, no coins, on the collection plate. And it worked a treat. When the collection plate went out, it was full of, you know, $10, $20, $50 notes. This is really good. So he decided he wouldn't do it next week, otherwise they'd soon suss him out. You know, because, you know, people are smart. So he waited for a few weeks until he needed some more money. And then again, turned the temperature up on a Sunday afternoon before they went to church. Gave a very boring sermon in a monotone. And then, when they're about to fall asleep, he got his watch out again. And he was just about to say, only $10, when he dropped his watch. And he just said, shit. And you know what happened next? This is what we mean about conditioning. They're all brainwashed as well. That's why we've never tried that trick here. Because it wasn't their fault. It wasn't their free will. They were forced to do that. Now do you understand what free will truly is? It's just so often that we're sort of controlled. And this is sometimes it happens in a partnership, just how we just try to control each other. So then we make our husband to follow our will, or we make our wife follow our will. Is that really a good relationship? Those of you who've been in such relationships, are they pleasant? Wouldn't it be more lovely to have even a relationship of real freedom? Freedom from control. This is actually why that I've made a long, big point over the last few years of talking about freedom and desires, and to see how the two are completely opposite. We talk now about the two types of freedom in the world. The freedom of desires is what people understand as free will. So that you can do whatever you want, whenever you want it, however you like it. And if you notice, this is how our society has been growing over the last few centuries. Giving people the power, the wealth, the means to fulfill whatever desire you want. Even whatever movie you want to listen to. You can go on Sky TV. You can get DVDs. You don't even need to go to the movie theatre anymore. Whatever food you want. You've got so many restaurants. Again, you don't even need to go out. You can ring up for home delivery. Whatever Dharma talk you want. We've got these MP3 CDs with hundreds of Dharma talks on. You don't even need to come to the centre now. You can listen to all this on the internet. Anything you want is getting more and more and more. Our society is called the free world by Mr. Bush, because, and Mr. Howard as well, and Mr. Blair, because they think this is the freedom of desires. But I ask you, how many of you really feel free? You are more wealthy than your parents. You've got more ability to come and go, to be entertained, than the people who came before you. But do you feel free? It's a strange thing that if you ask a person in our modern world, they don't feel free at all. And you come to our monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do anything else. This is a can't do monastery. It's all banned. You can't watch the TV, you can't watch movies, you can't listen to the radio, you can't sing songs, you can't play soccer. So many things. You can't even eat in the afternoon. You can't choose what you want to eat either. So many things you can't do. And you think, many people think, that must be terrible living in a monastery. All those rules. You must feel so confined, like you're being in a prison. What do you guys do that for? I've never felt so free in my life since becoming a monk. All these rules which I have to keep, they're so freeing. And this is why we got lots of people coming to our monastery. The ABC came there the last, it was last night, on Thursday night, doing a program for Negus. I think, was it Today Tonight or something, or Negus Tonight, on July the 13th, following a young man coming into our monastery. Asking, actually they were quite surprised again. They thought, your monastery is amazing. People are laughing, they're telling jokes. They thought it's supposed to be a serious place. You know me by now. Our monastery is not a serious place, it's a free place. We become monks for fun. We do. In fact, I'm a good time monk, I keep telling people. If you want a good time, what should you do? Be good. That's my saying. If you want a good time, then be good. But sometimes people think, that's really crazy. The only way you can have fun is to be naughty. Isn't that the case? People think naughty people have the most fun. They don't. You keep all these rules, you're confined, people think. That's what it looks like on the outside. But from the inside, you feel so free. It took me a while to understand this, and so I coined this term, the two types of freedom. The first is the freedom of desires, when you can do whatever you want, there are no rules. It's called the freedom of desires. The second type of freedom, what we monks get into, is called the freedom from desires. There's no desires left. There's no will to keep pushing you and pulling you the desire to be rich, the desire to be well-liked, the desire to be successful, even the desire to be healthy. Oh, if you're healthy, that's fine. If you're sick, that's part of life. Nothing wrong with that. Free from desires. Imagine that type of freedom, where you want for nothing, where you're completely content. Whatever comes, fine. If it doesn't come, fine. You're free from desires, where will has stopped. You're enjoying your life rather than always trying to control it. You're neither trying to control yourself, nor are you trying to control anybody else. Can you understand what that freedom is? Sometimes I'm going to the airport tonight to catch a plane. Sometimes I've seen the plane has been delayed. People get so upset and angry. What are you getting angry for? Does that make the plane go on time? You're just making yourself suffer. People complain when things go wrong because they're control freaks. They want to control the world. They don't want planes to not go on time. They don't want the traffic to sort of be so terrible. They don't want their children to not always become top of the class. We're so great control freaks. We want to control the world. At least you want to control your children. You want to control your partner. You want to control yourself. You want to control your body. I want to live a long time. I don't want to be sick. How many of you can do that? In the end, there's only one freedom. The freedom from desires. When you can love a partner and say, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you do or where you go. My love gives you freedom. I don't control you anymore. When you tell your kids, no matter what you do in your life, the door of my house will always be open to you. What my father said to me, complete freeing me. I didn't have to work hard to have his love. His love was a given. It will always be there, no matter what I did. He gave me freedom. I respected that so much, and I worked so hard to try and live up to him. This is what happens if you give your partner that type of freedom. This is what happens to you if you give yourself that degree of freedom. The door of my heart's open to me, no matter who I am, no matter what I ever do. No matter what I've done in life. Freedom from control. Like I said, in that forest, every tree is so important. Every experience in your life was absolutely necessary for you. Always wonderful things. Hard at the time, disgusting, but so useful. You wouldn't be who you are without those. When you understand that, you understand how you can love yourself. If you don't control anything, if you're going to give up control of something, or one thing in the world, give up control of yourself. Allow yourself to be. Let go. Be at peace. Have a bit of kindness to yourself. And then you have freed yourself from will. Freed yourself from the tyrant. Freed yourself from craving. Freed yourself enough to be completely liberated, to be enlightened, and join the ranks of the enlightened ones. The Buddha said it was craving which leads to suffering. You understand the connection between craving and will? Always moving, always going, seeking after something, grasping onto something, moving over here, chasing over there. When will there be an end to your journey? Will you ever have enough to stop? Only when you give up craving, you allow that craving-driven will to cease. So you allow yourself to be. You allow the world to be. You allow life to be. As it is, with its sickness, with its death, with its heat, with its cold, only then can you find real peace. This is the end of will. The Buddha said, from delusion comes will, sankhara, karma formations. From that comes the rebirth consciousness. It's called dependent origination, the first three factors. Through wisdom, when we see things as they truly are, there, the karma formations will stops. Through its stopping, there is no more rebirth. Samsara has been ended. I added that in there just to make this talk a little bit classy. That's dependent origination, first three factors. So there we go, that's the talk this evening on free will. I hope you've all been conditioned and brainwashed well enough by this evening's talk. And I forgot to get my clock out to get the donations, but never mind. I'm sure that our President Saul will be able to fix that one up. So thanks again for coming. So are there any questions about this evening's talk about free will, or rather the freedom from will? Yes, I've got a question, yeah. How do you work against aversion? Make peace with aversion. Like, aversion is just one of these clouds which come up into your mind. Trouble is, what most people do, they have aversion, some of them don't like, they get averse to aversion. So we get this double aversion. It's like we get guilty. We feel guilty about being guilty. I'm supposed to be a monk, I'm not supposed to feel guilty. So we feel guilty about being guilty. We have suffering. We don't want to have suffering. That's called double suffering. We're such complicated people that we actually add so much just to the normal things of the mind. If you've got aversion, make peace with aversion. Aversion, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. What you do then is actually you undermine aversion. Aversion, you're cutting off its fuel supply. It just burns out very quickly. Because when you make peace with aversion, then after a while, aversion cannot last. It cannot live there. You're just at peace with things, eh? So, aversion has come up in your mind because of old karma. The way you've been thinking in the past. The way you've used your mind in the past. And there it is. Here it is. It's aversion. Now, what am I going to do with it? You make peace with it. If you make peace with aversion, then making peace is the karma of the present. What are you doing with this? And then you find by making peace in the moment, making good karma now, the future must be good karma, good results. You're making peace in your mind. What you experience in the world is a result of the past. How you're experiencing it is how you're making your future. If you're averse to the aversion, aversion carries on. If you're at peace with aversion, then peace is what grows in the future. Is that clear? Okay. So what happens? Yes. Yeah, that's called jhanas. These are deep meditation states. This is how you can experience these things. These are not just talk. When you really let go, when you stop all this willing business. You know that great story about that little novice? I love telling this story. A little novice in Ajahn Chah's monastery many, many years ago. Ajahn Chah was giving this long sermon, many, many hours. This little novice kept on thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? He went on for about 2 or 3 hours like that. Until eventually the novice thought, when am I going to stop? And the novice stopped. And he only came out of his meditation many hours later. Ajahn Chah and all the monks had left the hall a long time ago. For the first time in his life, he got into the deep meditations where everything stopped. And it's actually a deep jhana experience. And even if a novice could do that, he just stopped all this winning business. He let go. Let it be. Loving kindness, the door of my heart's open to this. You're not doing anything. You're accepting, you're being. And there, the conditioning starts to end. So, it's not that hard to do. All you need to do is nothing. It's so hard. So whenever you're meditating, you find it's hard to do nothing. Ask yourself, why? Because will. There's always something that moves the mind. You have thought comes, I should do this, I should do that. That's called will. And even when you've got nothing to do, I should be doing something. That's will again. It's all conditioned. And I'm trying my hardest to uncondition you, or rather brainwash you so you see things a different way, so you can really let go, and you can at least be free. So there's not this person inside you always pushing you and pulling you. Ajahn Brahm, you should give a better talk. Ajahn Brahm, you should stop now. It's 4 minutes past nine. Ajahn Brahm, you should do this. I don't care. I'll just... be free. Okay, I should really stop now. Okay. Sorry, it's a bit late. But, come on, yes, have another one from Lawrence. Come on, you always ask good questions. Yeah, being content, exactly. Being content is how you do nothing. And after all, I mean, why do you strive so much? Because you want contentment, you want peace. You think, once I've got my beautiful house in the country, then I'll be content. Once I've paid off my mortgage, then I'll be content. Once my children have passed their exams, then I'll be content. So this is what desire does. It always puts off contentment. Haven't you got enough already? Hands up, those people have got enough. Come on, monks, put your hands up. Whenever can you retire? I retired at 23. Got no superannuation. Who needs superannuation? I don't believe a word of Mr. Costello. When you've got contentment, what more do you want? It's discontent. That's actually caught up with will. Discontent is actually what generates will. When we're discontent, we're willing to do something. When you're content, really content, all the will ends. You don't need much to be content. In fact, you don't need anything at all. You've already got enough to be absolutely content. I hope you're content, because that's all you're getting. Okay, come on, let's have some adverts now, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm.